think we're doing bad at all on as far as time goes and where we're at for the study. We're going to try to finish up, Lord willing, lesson 6 from last week, and I think we'll be able to do that. And then we will start with lesson 7, which covers chapter 8, verse 6, through the rest of chapter 8, which is verse 13. So far, has everyone finished the book of Hebrews? Read it at least once? Maybe start it again? It's a good book, and it's packed full of information. Did everyone from last week get a copy of the chart? Not the PowerPoint, but the chart that was beside the PowerPoint. It's on the back podium. If you didn't get that, we'll take a look at it tonight. Lord willing, it's in your PowerPoint slides, but it's so small in your handout that I wanted to make a larger handout for you so that you can have that. I think it makes a really good point. Last week we left off talking about Melchizedek, and we got to page 3, the last slide, which is on the screen, talking about the fact that he was a real person, and then some of the statements that the Hebrew writer makes relative to Melchizedek, verse 3 of chapter 7, without father, without mother, and so forth. Did anyone study any more on that and maybe come up with some additional thoughts that you want to share? It's interesting. And again, we're so limited to what we know about him that unless we stick with what is recorded in Genesis and what the Hebrew writer states here, we're really just going beyond what the Scriptures say and we just speculate. But keep studying that and seeing what you can find out. So verses 4 through 10 really talks about the greatness of Melchizedek. He says in verse 4, "Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of his spoils." Obviously, as we already looked at last week, this was prior to what? Prior to the law of Moses. Prior to the tribe of Levi. But what made Melchizedek great? First of all, we noticed two things about him. What were they?
King and priest.
King and priest. But Abraham gave a tenth to him, paid tithes to Melchizedek. And Melchizedek blessed him, but had the promises in reference to Abraham. Then verses 9 and 10, and you have these in your PowerPoint, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. But he says, "Levi also who receiveth tithes." What does it mean that Levi receives tithes? Melchizedek was paid tithes by Abraham, and now he's saying that Levi received tithes.
He was through the lineage of Abraham.
Yeah. Levi was from the lineage of Abraham, but who was Levi? What did that lead to? Levi and his sons. The priesthood, right? And what did the people do relative to tithes in the priesthood? They tithed and gave to God according as God had directed them to. It'd be interesting, I didn't put this in a slide, but a fellow made a statement about really how much the priest actually ended up getting. How much was that? They initially gave how much?
10%.
How much of that went to the priest? Or how much of that did he take of that portion? Go back and look at that and see what answer you come up with. And remind me next week and we'll come back and visit that. Just to dig further on it. But notice that he says, verse 9, "Levi also who receiveth tithes, paid tithes in Abraham." What does that mean, he paid tithes in Abraham? That's right. Verse 10 tells us the reason. "For as yet he was in the loins of Abraham." And so Melchizedek, and again, it's not the person that is being compared with Christ, but what is it? Not the person, but what?
The office.
The priesthood. The fact that he was king and priest, and the fact that Jesus occupies both of those roles. And I put those references in your handout. Verse 11, if therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood. And again, this word perfection is from this word which has to do with something reaching the desired result or end. Sometimes in the Bible, the word perfect means what? Means complete. Something that's not lacking. Here it's talking about something that is reaching the desired goal or end that God wanted it to. And he's saying the law of Moses, the Levitical priesthood, had a purpose. But in the great scheme of things, it did fulfill what God ultimately wanted done, and that was to reconcile man unto God. That wasn't done through the Levitical priesthood. The reconciliation of man to God, man's salvation, peace between man and God, cannot be reached by the Levitical priesthood. And so if it were by the Levitical priesthood, and then you've got that parenthetical statement that's in verse 11, for under it the people receive the law. But if perfection were by it, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? And we've already looked at the point that if, I'm getting ready to look at it again, but if the priesthood is changed of necessity, that meant what?
Change of law.
The change of the law. And again, there's not a doubt that these people would have had a hard time understanding the grasp of a change of the law. In fact, some of the historical writings say that sometime during the period between the Testaments, which was a period of how many years? 400 years. That the Jews had allowed other people to minister in the priest's office, but they were not willing to accept a change in the law, even though they accepted a change in who was able to sacrifice or minister in the tabernacle. I've not done a lot of reading on that. Maybe you have. But again, it's interesting that maybe they would have been lenient to that, but would not have been willing to accept a change of the law. The word order is from a word that means regular arrangement, fixed succession of rank or character. Again, we're not going to spend a lot of time on all of these, but verse 12, for the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. We're going to talk about that more in lesson 7, begin with chapter 8, verse 6. We've already talked about the fact that Jesus is the high priest. Are there people today that still advocate for an Aaronic priesthood? There is, right? Me and Larry just finished studying with a group of people. Well, we studied recently with a group that held to that. This means the law must have also been changed. Notice some statements made concerning Jesus. Things that you're very well familiar with. Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. If Jesus were on the earth, could he minister in the priest's office? Why not? He's in the wrong tribe. He couldn't have fulfilled that role even if he wanted to, if he were still on the earth. And neither was Melchizedek from Levi. And he was before that. But Jesus is high priest not after a carnal commandment. Some of you that do not use the King James Version, what is carnal commandment rendered as in your version? Yeah, verse 16. That's the idea behind it. You know how the Bible uses the word carnal, Romans and 1 Corinthians, means he was not genealogically connected to Aaron. And here's the chart that we're not going to spend a lot of time on, but I wanted you to have that. One of the reasons is because I don't know if in all the lessons that I've heard, and I know in all the lessons that I've done, on establishing authority, that I've ever thought about this point connected to that. Now, obviously, we talk about the silence of God. The silence of God is binding. If God didn't say it, then obviously that means that we have to leave it off. But notice what the Bible says in verse 14 of Hebrews 7. For it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses... What's the rest of that?
Spoke nothing.
Yeah, or spake nothing if you use King James Version. You know, he didn't say anything about that. That's a pretty interesting point. Here's a simple chart that points some of those things out. There was a specific commandment that Aaron's sons were to fulfill that role. If it were a general command that an Israelite could, and obviously anybody that was of any tribe could. God, at least on here, a genealogical chart would be an eight. But if they came along and said, well, I'm of the tribe of Judah, I want to fulfill the role of a priest, could they do that? But must change law by God's authority. It would be a change in His law. Think about preach the gospel. He didn't say just preach a message, did he? But preach the gospel. That's the message that we're to proclaim. It's not a general command. An overhead or a PowerPoint would just be an aid to do that, like we're using tonight. This is not in addition to the command to preach or to teach. But Judaism and Christianity would be an addition, and that would be going beyond what God stated. You go on down the line, communion, the bread, and fruit of the vine, eat and drink, place it, and so forth. What is singing? It says to make music, or to sing rather. The general command make music. But these are aids, but if we did that in addition, play in addition to singing, that changes the command, the gospel. But I want to give you that chart because it's a good point. Of which Moses spake nothing. How many of you have heard that in reference to establishing Bible authority? Me either.
That's kind of interesting. There's prophecies concerning, especially in Psalms 110 and verse 4, concerning that he was a priest for the rest of the court of Melchizedek. Not one verse relates to what tribe he was going to come from until spoken.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting.
So they would have been, you know, in the dark too at that time because he spoke nothing. The law of Moses concerned what tribe this priest was going to come from.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's interesting. So again, it shows us how when the Bible establishes something, we can't go beyond that. And we understand that in just about every area, but there's areas where sometimes individuals struggle because of various reasons. But you've got that in your PowerPoint. Verses 18 through 28 is concerning the law. Disannulling means a cancellation for the weakness and unprofitableness there. And I'll talk about that Sunday morning. But again, we need to observe that it's not that the law had no reason or that somehow God just made a mistake in implementing the Old Testament law of Moses. He's the one that gave them that law. In fact, if we get to tonight's lesson, lesson 7, we're going to talk about Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. And he specifically states in that reference that he made that law with them. That was God's doing. But when he talks about the weakness and unprofitableness of the law, what's he talking about? That it served no purpose at all? Is that what he means by it? So what's he talking about? Maybe you can remember back to Sunday morning.
Just the thought on the priesthood and the law, you could not have one without the other. The law must be the guideline for the priesthood of what they were to do. So it did serve a purpose that it guided the priest to how God wanted to be worshipped at that time. Mm-hmm. And the same thought that if the law was removed, the priesthood would be gone. The priesthood would remove the law. You know. Mm-hmm. You could not have one without the other. The law was made for the priesthood, of which they taught the people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There was a fellow who I recently heard make this statement, and it's a good statement, and I've not dug into it as much as I'd like to, but in verse 11, he was making the statement that when the Scriptures say, if therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, and the King James Version says for under, and some versions say for on the basis of it, the people received the law, he made the observation that if there was no priesthood, and you just had the law, when the people sinned or violated against the law, what was the penalty of that? Death, right? Separation from God. If there was no priesthood and no one to minister in the priesthood, how could they then have the forgiveness or make the atonement for what they had done? So I think it's pretty good rendering of on the basis of it. But God gave them the priesthood so they would have someone who, even as a mediator, that would offer sacrifice for the atonement of his sins and the sins of the people. Any other thoughts about that before we move on? So it had a purpose, and here's some references that talk about that. I'm not going to spend much time on that, that's what Sunday morning's lesson was on, but we understand wherefore then serveth the law. It was added for transgressions until the seed should come. And so the seed, has the seed came? Who is that? How do you know that? That's right. The Bible says so, right? So concerning the law, it was a disannulling or a cancellation of that. Jesus was made a surety of a better testament. I want to talk about better tonight. Of course, this is one of the key words of the book of Hebrews. It was not possible for the Old Testament priest to continue on by reason of death. They were going to die. Now, God had designed it so that when one died, they had someone else to step in and pick up the ball and keep going. But that, again, was based upon a carnal commandment. And so they died. But yet Jesus is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek because he what? He doesn't die. He died, was resurrected to see death no more. Verse 24, because Jesus lives forever, he has an unchangeable priesthood. Unchangeable means not passing away. And this was interesting, that it's non-transferable. That's another meaning of the word. And so if you study with people today who say that we still have a Aaronic priesthood, well, that was limited to the tribe of Israel. If you say that there are people today that minister in a priest's office who are not of the tribe of Levi, and they say, well, they received it because of Jesus, that word pinpoints it down that Jesus is the high priest. It's not changeable and it's not transferable to anyone else. He's the sole person that occupies that role today. John 14:6, obviously Jesus is the only way that man can come to God. Verse 25, he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him. Concerning Jesus, the Bible says he's holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, higher than the heavens. We know what holy means. We know what harmless and undefiled means. Obviously, he didn't have sin. Obviously, relative to harmless, there's not a thing that he did with any bad motive or ulterior motive. But when it says that he was separate from sinners, what does that mean? If you were to look that up into some commentaries, you'd find at least two ways that people render that. You'll just have to make your own mind up on it. But how can you take that? What does it mean that Jesus was separate from sinners? Let me throw two out to you and you tell me which one fits the context of it and fits the life that Jesus lived. Is it that Jesus is separate from sinners because he never mingled with sinners, never had anything to do with sinners, separated himself from sinners? Or is it that Jesus was taken from the earth and passed through the heavens to where he is now on the right hand of God? Or do you have a third?
I was thinking, even though he associated, he was not as a sinner. He was pure, even though he associated, which is what a Christian is today. We're in the world, we would be separate from the world. No, just that's what my thoughts are.
And there are places even in the New Testament, be therefore separate, not to join in or to fellowship with unfruitful works of darkness.
In the heavens, not up there, just my thoughts are.
Yeah, and then higher than the heavens. How is he higher than the heavens? We've already looked at that so far in our study. How is he higher than the heavens? Remember, what did the Bible say that he passed through the heavens? Remember we talked about that? Still mentioned again that he's passed through the heavens and sits on the right hand of the Father. 27 and 28, Jesus has offered himself once and needeth not to continue to do so. Again, the high priest, what did they have to do on a continual basis? They had to offer sacrifices. Now, the atonement or the sin offering, the atonement that was how many times a year? That was offered within the veil. Once a year. Were there other sacrifices that went on? What kind of sacrifices? Peace offerings, wave offerings. So a lot of different sacrifices that he had to stand and offer on a continual basis. But Jesus didn't do that. We'll notice what he says concerning that in just a moment. It could, Larry, and I don't think if that is a rendering of that would do injustice to the context of it. I mean, certainly he had no sins, committed no sins, makes that statement in chapter 4. And so when he died, it wasn't for himself that he offered the sins, but for the people. So, good thought. So we've expanded that from two statements to four. So you can study that and make up your mind about that. Any thoughts about that? He once offered himself, needeth not to continue to do that. Some statements that are made too along the way about once. That, in other words, his work as in a priestly role as far as offering sacrifices is finished. Done. It's completed. Now, he makes intercession. We understand that. But the fact that he has offered a sacrifice for the sins of the people, shed his blood for the remission of sins, he's done that and doesn't need to do that on a continual basis. Chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. Now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. Now, here's another point that you might think is just a small point, but again, I didn't know this. And probably because I had never made a comparative study about it, but that the word sum in chapter 8, verse 1 actually means the main point. And I think some of the versions talk about that. You know, sometimes we look at sum in the Bible and we automatically think of what? We have a school teacher among us. What do you think of when you think about sum? Yeah, the total. And that's not, again, injustice to what the context is saying. But really, he's saying, here's the point. In light of what has just been laid out up to this point, here is the main point, the thrust of what he's saying. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Relative to when the priests offered sacrifices, were they standing or sitting? And the book of Hebrews made that point that they stood in their role to God. Not so with our high priest. But we have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of God. Also, that means authority. We've looked at that so far. Jesus has all authority. The right hand of the throne signified authority. But the point being, he has once offered himself for the sins of the people. His priestly duty has been completed and fulfilled. I think that's the gist behind that word, once. The priest, again, stood in their function as priests, Hebrews chapter 10, verse 11. He ministers in a sanctuary. We're going to talk about that. That's one of our sections of the book, which the Lord pitched and not man. Verse 4 would indicate the book was penned prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, which was AD 70. How would we be able to rightly say that? What at the time, before the destruction of Jerusalem, what was still taking place in Jerusalem, even though the Old Testament law had passed away, been done away with? You still had sacrifices being offered because you still had Jews that had not been converted to Christianity. Now notice what the verse says. For if he, talking about Christ, were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law. What does he mean in the present tense that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law? The Old Testament law was done away with even when the Hebrew writer was penning this. There's, without doubt, some of the people were still following that. I mean, even in the other writings that Paul wrote, people were still observing the Old Testament law of Moses. You had the Jerusalem Convention, or however you want to call that, in Acts chapter 15, when they had the issue of what part of the law? Circumcision. Sent back to Jerusalem to the elders and the apostles to see what they would say about that. And so there were still people who were trying to bind the Old Testament law on the Jews. The shadow of heavenly things have been replaced by the very things themselves. And hopefully you've read the book. That brings us to lesson 7 with about 6 or 7 minutes to go. Almost hesitate to start this, but we're at least going to look at some of it. In verse 6, but now hath he obtained, who is that talking about? He. Christ hath obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is a mediator of, and here's our key word again, one of them, a better covenant which was established upon better promises. The word covenant, you no doubt already know this, means a disposition or a contract, an agreement between at least two parties. Yet it says that Jesus' ministry is far more excellent than that of Aaron's. Now, folks, I have to have help with Greek words because I don't know Greek. But you tell me how you can get any better than excellent. If I say that a cup is full of water, how can it get any more full than full? So what's the point by saying that his ministry is far more excellent than Aaron's? Can you get any better than excellent? What's the point that he's trying to get us to see? Surpasses that. Even if you had the idea that once you got all the way perfectly full, his is beyond that. And so he's basically telling us that the ministry that Jesus has is a lot better, is a lot higher than Aaron's for a number of reasons. Why would his ministry be more excellent than the ministry of the Levitical priesthood? What role? I mean, Jesus has the role of high priest, but how's that better of a ministry than what they ministered under the Old Testament? Okay, it was just a shadow of what was to come. And so Jesus is the actual, the fulfillment of that, or the real itself, not just a shadow. The whole book is emphasizing what?
Superiority.
No, that he's superior. Well, how is it then that his ministry is superior than to Aaron's ministry? Did Aaron not stand on behalf of the people? A go-between in between the people and God? Well, Jesus does too. So how is his superior?
I think it relates back to verse 8 when we talk about the word perfection. Uh-huh. That his ministry accomplished what? As not, as well as the word uttermost, he's able to save them to the extent of which his ministry will save them, the uttermost.
That's right. So, Yeah. Even if they had kept every part of the law blameless, they could not have what we have this side of the cross. That wasn't the purpose it was given in the first place. And I think that's a good point, the fact that all that come unto Jesus. People could have went to the tabernacle, could have went out to the physical tabernacle and offered those sacrifices, appeared before the priest and had the priest to make the sacrifice on behalf of them. And that was never going to take away, never going to take it away. And here's just simply for your benefit on what ministry means. It actually comes from a word where we get our English word liturgy from. Mediators, from a word that means a go-between, an internunciator, or a reconciler. When you think about somebody mediating, what do you think about? Mark's been in the court system a whole lot. What do you think about mediation?
A party that argues for both sides.
Yeah, that's right. It really is a stand-between or a go-between. I remember being in the court when a parent perhaps is accused of doing something, abuse or neglect, and we file that petition and we go to court, and before the adjudication there's a mediation where there's a guardian ad litem, maybe the parent's attorney or something, and you're trying to come to an agreement. You have that person who's in between those two parties. Well, who would the two parties be relative to spiritual things? That reconciliation, but who's the mediator? It's not Aaron. It's not the priesthood. It's Christ. And here these people were in danger. Our time's just about gone, but these people were in danger of leaving the testament that provided them a high priest, a mediator, a testator of a better covenant built upon better promises. And they're getting ready to turn their back on it, or at least in danger of that, I should say. 1 Timothy 2:5 makes it clear that Jesus is a mediator, the one mediator between God and man. We didn't get too far into this lesson, but we'll, Lord willing, come back to it next week and finish this one up and maybe start the next one. Again, I don't think we're too far behind on it, being in chapter 8. We're almost... chapter 8, rather. So that leaves us with a few more chapters. Any thoughts or comments about it? It's a good study. Keep reading the book of Hebrews and dig. And if you have thoughts or comments about what is discussed in the class, or maybe we've not spent time on something that you learned and you want to share it with the rest of us, you feel more than free to do that. Appreciate your good attention.